I am most pleased to tell you today about a remarkable man who I've observed at relatively close range now for over three decades. That makes us sound pretty old, but we knew each other when we were very young. Brother Mark H. Willis comes to us today as one of the outstanding leaders in American business. He is the President and Chief Operating Officer of General Mills Corporation, where he was appointed to that assignment in 1985. He has responsibility for all groups, including restaurants, grocery products, and convenience and international foods. He joins General Mills in 1980 as their Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, and a member of the company's Management Policy Committee, and then was elected to the Board of Directors of the company in 1984. Prior to General Mills, Mr. Willis served as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, where in 1977, at age 35, he became the youngest person ever to serve as a president of one of the Federal Reserve Banks in America. Previously, he had been associated with the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia as an economist and research director. Brother Willis graduated from Columbia College, New York City, majoring in statistics, and received his Ph.D. in 1967 from Columbia Graduate School of Business, concentrating in areas of banking, economics, and finance. While working on his doctorate, Brother Willis was an instructor in finance at Columbia University Graduate School of Business. He has also been on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania and the University of Wisconsin. He serves as a member of the Board of Directors of the Black & Decker Corporation and Talbots. He is a member of the National Advisory Council, the School of Management of Brigham Young University, and the Dean's Advisory Council of the Columbia Business School. He has established himself as a leader in the world of finance and business management. Brother Willis has received numerous honors. In 1979, he was named by Time magazine as one of the 50 faces of America's future. He was honored at Ricks College in 1988 as the outstanding business leader of the year. Brother Willis is an outstanding priesthood leader in the church. He served for 9 years as president of the Minneapolis stake. 18 of our student body come from that stake, and several of them are seated on the stand giving moral support today. He also has been in a bishopric and high councils and in a stake presidency, and he now teaches a gospel doctrine class. He and his lovely wife, Fayon Bingham Willis, are the parents of five children. Brother Willis has a niece who's seated by him today, Charlotte Strife, and an adopted niece, her friend Heather Corey. We're honored to have with us today Brother Mark H. Willis.
Thank you very much, President Bennion. It is a distinct honor and privilege for me to be able to be with you today. I can't help but smile every time that business in Time magazine is mentioned, where I was, quote, one of the 50 faces for America's future. I mean, when you've got a face like mine, it makes you worry about the future of the country. Shortly after I went to General Mills, one of the fellows reporting to me was the director, one of the members of the board of directors of the Minnesota Zoo. And I had always wanted to go to the zoo, hadn't had an opportunity up to that point, so I went to him and I said, Jim, you're a director of the zoo. I'd really like to go see the zoo. And he said, Mark, when they want you, they'll come for you. So I have no illusions about my face or about anything else. As I look out at all of these absolutely marvelous students, I'm reminded of the first class I taught as a freshly minted PhD student. It was my first full-time faculty position at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. I was excited. I thought the students would be excited. I got to class, and on my desk, one of the students had left the following quote: "Socrates was a great teacher. He went around giving a lot of advice. They poisoned him." I wasn't quite sure what that meant at the time, but I never quite put it to the test. I was a very careful teacher not to give too much advice until that class had graduated. Let me tell you how fortunate you are to have President Bennion as your college president. He is right. We've known each other for a long time. We first met when we were high school students. If you'll think back to the not so long a time when you were high school students, you probably say, as I have always done, "Thank heavens that time in my life is over. I hope I do better from now on." President Bennion, on the other hand, was everybody's idol. He was the all-star halfback on the football team. He was student body president. He had that marvelous, handsome, curly hair that he now has. He had a little more then than he now has, but nevertheless, it was wonderful. Everybody looked up to him, admired him, and I will have to say I was one of those who did very much. As we have known him and his lovely wife, Marge, over the years since then, we have come to love and appreciate them like our own family. How blessed you are to have people not only of good breeding, not only of great minds, but of loving hearts to be your leaders. You are fortunate indeed. Now, I'm particularly grateful also to have Charlotte and Heather and others from the Minneapolis Stake on the stand with me today. I hope they know how much I love them and how special it is for me to have this opportunity to see them. I wish I could in some way convey to you how much you mean to me. No, it's true, I don't know most of you personally, but I do know a great deal of your circumstance and of your promise. I feel I have some insight into what the Lord expects of you. And therefore, I am both honored and humbled to be asked to speak to you at this devotional. I've worried a lot about what I might say, particularly at these sobering times when men and women are dying as they strive to protect things that we hold dear. And after a lot of thinking and praying, and at the suggestion and with the blessing of President Bennion, I've decided to speak with you for a few minutes on the subject of courage. That combination of inner strengths and will that allows us to overcome obstacles, to face fear, and to move forward with confidence and grace. And to start at the end, so there is no question about the conclusion that I hope we can all come to together. Courage, in my judgment, is the result of purpose and faith. It is having and sensing within us a deep and, yes, even a divine purpose, and then having the faith that as we pursue that purpose, we will receive help from our Father in heaven, and therefore we'll be able to do more and do it better than we ever dreamed possible. Now, I'd like to talk about courage today and in part share some personal experiences with you. I apologize for that in advance. It's awkward to share with those that you don't know things that are personal about you. But then courage is personal because it's inner. And we really only come to understand courage as we come to understand ourselves and the challenges that we face as we seek to develop both purpose and faith. I hope as I share those experiences, I will not do that in any way that's inappropriate or unappealing. I hope you will take them in the spirit in which they're given. Let me start by sharing with you an experience I had as a college student, almost exactly your age, at Columbia University in New York City. I went from Salt Lake City, where I went to high school, to New York City. Went from a relatively politically conservative environment to one of the hotbeds of liberalism. In the 1950s, Columbia was as liberal as any place there was in the United States. My second year there, I decided, because I needed to take a class on how to write. I should have taken that the first year, but I wasn't smart enough, so I took it the second year. I'm sure you all know how to write. I did not know how to write effectively. So I took a class from an English professor on how to write. Having spent over a year listening to all of these liberal professors and students, wondering what I was doing in this rather interesting place, we were talking about a paper one day that had been written about the Second World War, and this very liberal professor made a remarkable statement. He said, "This paper is balderdash. It is mamby-pamby. It does not deal with the very serious issue, which is that World War II was a fight between the forces of good and the forces of evil." I was stunned. I was amazed. Here was a statement that I could identify with. Here was a statement that I agreed with. Here was a statement of absolute courage, a precise and deep understanding of the nature of World War II. It was a fight between good and evil. Today, in various places around the world, particularly at this time in the Middle East, we're in the midst of a fight between good and evil. There are men and women of great courage on both sides. I have admired, as I'm sure you have, the courage with which our fighting men and women day after day have faced the dangers that they have faced, some already having given their lives. Tragically, many yet will likely do so. For us to win, we must have both those who fight and those who don't, enormous courage based on a profound sense of purpose and an abiding faith that our cause is just. Let me read to you out of the Doctrine and Covenants a very interesting set of verses that I suggest relate to the circumstances in which we find ourselves today. "Behold, this is the law I have given unto my servants Nephi and thy fathers Joseph and Jacob and Isaac and Abraham and all my ancient prophets and apostles. And again, this is the law that I gave unto my ancients, that they should not go out unto battle against any nation, kindred, tongue, or people, save I, the Lord, commanded them. And if any nation, tongue, or people should proclaim war against them, they should first lift a standard of peace unto that people, nation or tongue. And if that people did not accept the offering of peace, neither the second nor the third time, they should bring these testimonies before the Lord. Then I, the Lord, would give unto them a commandment and justify them in going out to battle against that nation, tongue, or people. And I, the Lord, would fight their battles and their children's battles and their children's children's until they had avenged themselves on all their enemies. Interesting to hold up what's going on in the Middle East to that particular standard. It seems clear to me that we will not win the war based on advanced technology, although that is certainly helpful, but rather because there are men and women of great courage on both sides. We will only win the war if our cause is just. If our cause is just, we can then count on the Lord to help us. I have admired the courage of many that I have seen interviewed, both those who are fighting and the families of those who are fighting. I have particularly appreciated the prayerful way that many of them have responded, acknowledging that they can only be effective if they depend on their Father in heaven. This is a test of courage, a test of purpose and of faith. Fortunately, most of us do not have to test our courage on the battlefield, although perhaps some of us will. Nevertheless, we face every day, in every aspect of our lives, challenges, obstacles, and difficulties that require great courage, require, in my judgment, the same kind of courage with which we now see our fighting men and women display. Fortunately for us, our obstacles are not usually life and death. Often they seem at the time small, not extraordinary. And yet it often turns out that it is precisely in those circumstances when our courage is tested that the consequences are in fact the greatest. Let me tell you a story. Some years ago when I was at the Federal Reserve Bank in Philadelphia, I was responsible for all of the operations of the bank. As President Benjamin mentioned, before that I'd been an economist. I thought big thoughts and wasn't responsible for anything. It was a wonderful job. Suddenly, I found myself responsible for all of the operations in the bank. I knew someplace in the bank we had a vault. And I knew in that vault we had about $18 billion worth of cash and government securities. So I asked the guy who was responsible for the vault to take me down and show me where the vault was, since I was now responsible for it. So we went down and we saw the vault. It had walls 4 feet thick made out of concrete and steel and steelcrete. It had mirrors so you could see all the way around. It had electronic viewing devices. It had wires. I mean, it was an absolutely impregnable vault, I was told. About 3 months later, an FBI agent walked into my office and he said, "We have reason to believe somebody's stealing money out of your bank." Well, I said, "It can't happen. I've been down to see the vault. You can't get into it. Nobody can do that." I called the man back in who was responsible for the vault. I said, "This FBI agent says somebody's stealing money out of our bank." He said, "It can't happen. We have all these walls and so on. They can't get the money out." The FBI agent said, "We think somebody's taking money out of your bank." 3 months later, that FBI agent walked out of our bank with 10 of our employees who together had stolen $1.6 million in cash. The first one arrested was the son of a minister. He was 19 years old. He himself had gone to divinity school. His father was a minister. His grandfather was a minister. The second one arrested was a 21-year-old daughter of the deputy sheriff. The third one arrested was the 20-year-old son of a Philadelphia policeman, and so on down the line. With one exception out of those 10, if you had had them stand up here in front of you, the honest truth is they would have looked just like you. They were clean cut. They came from good homes. They should have been, in every respect, outstanding young men and young women. And instead, they were on their way to the county courthouse to be charged with grand theft. I talked to them and to the agent to find out what had happened. It started with the one of the 10 observing, and that one was a rotten apple. I mean, he was bad. He happened to notice one day in the cash vault where we had coins, two of these outstanding young people slipping a quarter in their pocket. The reason they had taken the quarter was because they wanted to see if they could beat the system. They didn't really need a quarter. A quarter wasn't even enough. Well, I guess at that point it could buy an ice cream cone, was about what it could buy. It wasn't the money. It was just, I wonder if we can beat the system. It was kind of a lark. Let's see if we can overcome this intense security and beat the system. So they took a quarter. He watched them the next day and they took 2 quarters. He watched them a few more times and they were taking a dollar, maybe $2 a day. That's all they intended to do. Until he came up to them and he said, I know what you've done. And unless you help me, I will report on you and you will be fired. And they were so embarrassed and chagrined by what they had done that they decided that they would collude with him. And there's no security system I know of that is good enough that if you have enough collusion, you can't beat it. And that's exactly what they did. And by the time they were finished, the collusion group consisted of 10. And on the last theft, they walked out with $900,000 in cash. It started with a quarter, and it ended up with jail. They lost not only their jobs, but their reputation and their opportunities, because they didn't have the courage, first of all, not to take the quarter. And then when they were confronted with that, they didn't have the courage to own up to it and take the consequences when the consequences would have been small, and instead allowed themselves to be dragged in until the consequences were horrendous. Each of us, day in and day out, are tempted by friends or by the adversary. It is the courage to make the small decisions right that most of the time will either present to us great opportunity or great difficulty. Let me tell you quickly, small decisions that I know of. And since they're about me, you can imagine these are hopefully positive decisions that show you what a difference a small thing can make. One year I was in China, about 11 years ago. Our group took us, we were being hosted by the Ministry of Agriculture, and our group took us to the Peking Duck restaurant in Peking. It's now called Beijing, then it was called Peking. And we were having Peking duck dinner in the Peking duck restaurant in Peking. The way it was set up was that there was a member of our group in one chair. On my right was somebody from the Ministry of Agriculture, and on my left was somebody from the Communist Party. The man from the Ministry of Agriculture was a pleasant-looking sort of fellow. The man from the Communist Party looked exactly like my stereotype then was of somebody from the Communist Party. I mean, I thought he was going to kill me if I looked wrong. Across from me was the number three man in the Ministry of Agriculture, which, if you recognize that there are 700 million farmers in China, he was a man of some importance. The way the dinner worked was that after each course, you would have a toast with Mai Tai, which is just straight alcohol. Those of you from the South who know what white lightning is, white lightning, I'm told by my friends at the dinner table, tastes like lemonade compared to Mai Tai. Really strong stuff. They brought out the first course. The first course happened to be the heart of the duck. I ate the heart of the duck. That was actually quite good. The second course came out. It was looked a little bit like potato chips. It turned out to be the skin of the duck, French fried. That was actually quite good. The third course that came out was kind of orange. Looked a little bit like orange jello. You learn, by the way, when you travel much overseas, you never ask what it is until after you've eaten it. I took my chopsticks, put that in my mouth. I chewed. It tasted like orange jello with gristle in it. It was awful. I finally was able to swallow it. I then turned to the interpreter and said, "What was that that I just ate?" He said, "Oh, that was the webbed foot of the duck." I now began to understand why they would have a toast of Mai Tai after every meal. As they would toast with Mai Tai, I would toast with a little glass of orangeade. Members of the church don't drink alcohol. I have never, to my knowledge, had any alcohol. I had my orangeade. After the seventh course, the number three man in the Ministry of Agriculture got a very dark look on his face. And he said through the interpreter, pointing at me, "You tell him that it is our tradition to toast with Mai Tai." And he was angry. And if you know anything about China, you know that this notion of tradition is very important. I could see the Communist Party man stiffen. My life went before me. I could see myself rotting away in a Chinese prison. I mean, it was just awful. I said the fastest prayer I have ever said in my life. Now, you see, the interesting thing is, if we have decided what our purpose is and we have faith, even in the small things we will get help. My purpose was to keep the commandments. That was a righteous purpose. I therefore had the right to petition my Father in heaven for help. I didn't have any idea what to do. I said this prayer quickly in my mind, leaned back in my chair, and the thought came to me, and I picked up my toast, my little glass of orangeade, and I said, "Please tell my distinguished and gracious host that it is my tradition to toast with orangeade." He did just what you did. He smiled. He laughed. The man from the Communist Party laughed. We all laughed. And the crisis was over. That's a very small thing. But oh, I can tell you, as a little boy from West High School in Salt Lake City in a very faraway country, wondering what on earth I was going to do, I was grateful for this idea, this fact, that if our purpose is right, and if we have faith, the Lord will bless us and help us, even in the small things. Let me tell you one other story quickly about small things, and then I'll get on. When I was at the Federal Reserve Bank in Philadelphia, I would go once a year to the meetings of the Federal Open Market Committee in Washington, D.C., I would only go once a year because the president of the bank would go regularly, and I would only go since I had the number two job as his substitute. So I was down there substituting for him one day, and it came my turn to speak about what I thought monetary policy should be, this policy that determines what's going to happen to money and interest rates and credit and all that kind of stuff. And I said to myself, well, I'm only here once a year. I'm going to give it my whole shot. I'm going to tell him what I think. Sitting across the table from me was the man who was then chairman at that time, Arthur Burns. Arthur Burns had an exact and precise idea of the outcome that he wanted for that meeting. As he listened to me start to talk, he realized that what I was going to say was inconsistent with what he wanted to have happen. So he stopped me. He interrupted me. He stopped me. The prudent thing to do would have been to stop. But I felt I was right. It's a habit that those of us who are stubborn have. We always feel we're right. And so he interrupted me, and as soon as he finished, I went on, and he stopped me again. And as after he finished interrupting me, thinking for sure he had stopped me this time, I went on and finished. And he was angry. This kid from Philadelphia, what on earth was he doing messing up this meeting? I mean, he was just absolutely fuming. As luck would have it, we ended up in the elevator together going to lunch after the meeting. And he wheeled around and turned on me and he said, didn't I have you as a student at Columbia? He'd been one of my professors as a graduate student. I said, yes, as a matter of fact, you did. He said, what grade did I give you? I said, well, under the circumstances, I'm sorry to tell you, you gave me an A+. Two years later, when my name came before the Board of Governors to be approved to be president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, there was expected to be a fairly lively discussion because I was, as President Bingham mentioned, 35 years old. Nobody had ever been appointed who was 35 years old before. They weren't sure that it would be approved. My name came on the table. Arthur Burns, who was still chairman, said, before anybody else could speak, well, of course we will approve him. He was one of my students, and I gave him an A+. Again, a very small, seemingly insignificant exchange had consequences far beyond what I could have ever dreamed. Now the question is, how do we get courage? If courage is a function of purpose and faith, rather than talk about it, rather than listen to it, how do we get it? As stake president, I set apart almost 300 missionaries. I would watch them go. I would have them come back and report. And it became absolutely obvious to me that in every case, the Lord had sent them on a specific mission. It was not a coincidence where they went. They went to that place where they could impact on people that were uniquely prepared for them, and they went to that place where they would have the experiences that they needed for their growth and development. As I saw this happen, not once, not twice, but hundreds of times, I began to have this idea in my mind that a full-time mission is symbolic of our life's missions. That before we came, our Father in Heaven, or one of His agents, in fact set us apart for a specific mission, for a specific purpose, that we then come, hopefully we serve well, and we then return and report. Elder Maxwell once said, "It does no violence, even to our frail human logic, to observe that there cannot be a grand plan of salvation for all mankind unless there is also a plan for each individual." Therefore, our purpose, our objective in life, is not to find out what we want to do. Our purpose is to find out what we are intended to do. And once having discovered through thought and prayer and ultimately inspiration from our Father in heaven, once we know what we are to do, then we can go forward with full confidence, knowing that we are doing the things that the Lord has sent us here to do, and also knowing that He will then bless us with the talents and abilities and characteristics that we need to accomplish the things that He has sent us here to do. Surely, if we are about His purposes, He will bless us so that we can accomplish it. And think for a minute of the staggering implications of that. It means that He cares about how well we do at school. It means that He cares about where we serve our mission. It means that He cares about who we marry. It means that He cares about where we live. It means that He cares about every aspect of our lives, because who we marry, how we do in school, what we do for a profession, where we live, all of those things impact on our lives and our ability to impact on the lives of others. And therefore, yes, it is appropriate to pray for who to marry. Yes, it is appropriate to pray about where to go to school and every other aspect of our lives, because to our Father in heaven, they're all one. There is no difference between our spiritual life and our temporal life and our family life. It is all one, and therefore it is all appropriate and subject to deep and abiding prayer. Let me conclude with two quick stories. The first story relates to the fact that before the Lord can help us, we have to do our own effort and our own work first. Remember this vault in Philadelphia that I talked about? I took my children down there one day. Thought they might like to see $18 billion, just for the fun of it. The man who was in the vault saw us coming, and so he got out two items. First item was a brick of new $20 bills, that is, those that had been freshly printed at the mint and were sitting there in the vault. A brick, which is about like that, of new $20 bills is worth about $20,000. Then he went to a drawer and got out a sheet of paper, a single sheet of paper about this size, had a bunch of scribbling on it. Showed that to our two daughters, one of whom at the time was about 7 and one was 5 or something like that. Said, which would you like? Well, they'd sold enough lemonade on the golf course to know that a $20 bill was really something. And if that was full of $20 bills, that would really be something. So they chose the brick of $20 bills. Oh, what a horrible, uninformed mistake. Because the sheet of paper that he was holding up was a negotiable U.S. government security worth $200 million. Because they didn't know, they made the wrong choice. That's why the Lord gives us these. That's why our professors give us texts. The Lord is not going to do our homework for us. He expects us to learn and to know. And when we come to having to make decisions between $20,000 and $200 million, if it's really just that simple, He expects us to have done our homework and to know what the answer is. If, however, there is something that we can't know by our own study, or something that we need to have confirmed to us, then obviously He will bless us and help us with that answer. If I had time, I would read to you from one of the men of great courage, Let me just read two verses. One of the great heroes of all time, somebody who had purpose and faith, who as a lad younger than you went out to fight Goliath. And Saul said unto David, Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth. And David said unto Saul, Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and I took a lamb out of the flock. And I went after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And then finally in Isaiah, They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. I hope and pray each one of us will discover the purpose for which we are here. We then have the right to call on faith on our Father in heaven, and He will help us be better than we ever dreamed we could be. We can approach the future with courage if we have purpose, if it's a righteous purpose, and if we have faith in Him who gave it to us. May we do it, I pray, in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.